Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening and welcome to Murder 1, 2, 3. So this is John, and boy, do we have a special, special evening for you. After last week, we had part one of Helter Skelter, Charles Manson. We talked about Robbie Beausoleil and all the crazy stuff that happened. Well, tonight, we've got our entire cast back, our great co-hosts, and we've got a superb guest. So first of all, as I like to do, I like to go around the room and say hello to all of our co-hosts. See how in these dastardly days of coronavirus. First of all, from Hollywood, California, Devin Tate, how are you doing?
Hey, John, I'm doing great. Enjoying 420 today.
Well, I was getting ready to say today is 420. You can't get any more interesting than that, can you?
Right?
All right. Well, you know, happy to the one and only Jimi Hendrix. Pop Crow and I talked about the great Jimi Hendrix yesterday when we interviewed the lovely Diane Pope of the Tams, the great R&B group from Atlanta, Georgia. So anyway, we're glad to have you here, and happy 420 to you. And speaking of Papa Stro, the maestro of wrestling from Emerald Isle, South, North Carolina, how are you doing tonight, buddy?
As good as I can be. Just got to watch a little bit of Monday Night Raw and just here with you guys.
Well, we're thrilled. We can't do this without you. Thanks a lot. And speaking of can't do it without you, here she is, the one and only, the queen of murder, 1, 2, 3. I hope that doesn't sound terrible. Robin McCray, how are you doing tonight, Robin?
I'm doing good. Hey, guys.
Hello, Robin.
Hey. Hi, Robin.
You know, Robin, I hope you don't mind me calling you the queen of murder, 1, 2, 3.
No.
That is an affectionate and lovely title. We have given you and the Queen of England are the only two queens that we recognize. So, I mean,
hey, I'll
take
that.
Well, great. We're so glad you will, and thank you. And from the murder capital of the world, Harlan, Kentucky. Although Harlan may get to Wuhan, China. Here he is, Tony Pelosi, paranormal investigator at large. How are you doing tonight?
I am doing wonderful, John. I can't wait to get going on Manson Part 2. This is going to be an awesome show. The Guilt Pump from last week, it was a great show.
Well, it really was, and I actually had I had a number of comments and emails that people really enjoyed the show. Well, tonight is an extra special night because not only do we have the representative from Hollywood, California, do we not only have Papa Stro, the maestro of wrestling, who has appeared in front of tens of people, Robin McCray, the famed remote viewer, and of course you, Tony. Tonight we have Scott from Los Angeles, California. And Scott, how are you doing tonight? Hello?
I don't hear him.
Scott, are you there? It's like John Cena. We can't see him. Don't hear
him. Do what? Well, I'm back now. Scott, are you there with us? Hello.
He's lost in the murder portal, John.
Yeah.
Well, he looks like. Oh my goodness, he looks like he's on here from 213.
Hey, it's Devin, 420 day. You never know, right?
Now, Devin, are you still there? Did our connection get cut from
the
West Coast?
Here.
All
here.
Right, and our guest seems to be still on here. And is he here? I hope I didn't do anything wrong. Well, Devin, I tell you what, if you ask, would you text our guest star tonight and tell him to hang up and just come right back?
Yeah, for sure. Nope, not
do that, and I'm going to, because I know, to be honest with you, I just about lost contact with everybody here about 2.5 minutes ago, so I'm going to, we'll just wait, and we look forward to having him back, and we've got a lot to talk about, because we've got Charles Manson, and I'll tell you, we'll mention a bit about coronavirus, because it looks like Myrtle Beach is going to reopen here in about 2 weeks. And so everybody can come down to Myrtle Beach before the disaster hits. Robin, you and I were talking about the potential disaster. Do you mind giving us
this isn't going to be good.
Pardon?
I said this isn't going to be good.
Now, why is that?
Well, the whole reason that things have gotten a little better with the coronavirus is because we're all kept separate. And quite honestly, there's still a lot of people that don't listen to that. And you go to the store in the time that it's allowed, and people are standing on top of you. It's ridiculous. But the truth of the matter is there has been some social distancing. Well, not enough. There has been some going on. Now, they claim that, you know, things are going better. They're going better because nobody's out there. I mean, there's still a lot of people out there that don't believe that this is serious, and, you know, may God help them. But the truth of the matter is there isn't as many people out there as there was before. That's why they think it's getting better. Also,
hello?
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 Where'd Robin
looks like go? Robin. It looks like Robin faded away.
Oh, my goodness.
She was dropping a truth bomb, and they cut her off. It's a conspiracy.
She was cutting a great promo, too. What a great promo she was cutting. Jeez,
I love
really?
It. I know.
Oh, here she comes. Robin's smart enough. She knows exactly when to call. Robin, are you back
I'm
with
back.
Us?
Yeah.
I'll tell you what. We are having some strange things happening tonight on the Internet. And as Papa Stroh said, you were dropping the best promo he'd heard. So please continue.
Well, the thing is, I've talked to the nurses at the hospital. The deaths and the amount of people that have this virus has been totally dumbed down. They are not reporting all of them. And I don't know about everybody else, but here in South Carolina, we've got cases going crazy. And what they're doing is, from my understanding, from what I have heard, they're getting ready to reopen the state May 1st. Well, the problem with that is that the virus hasn't been killed. It's not out of here. It's not going to for some time. They're talking it could be 18 months to get it out of here. And it's also going to come in waves.
Yep.
Even when they had the pandemic diseases before, whether it be the flu, smallpox, whatever, they've come in waves. And we're going to get hit with another wave of this. And we're going to be caught off guard like we did the first time because we've opened up too soon. Now, I would, like everybody else, I would love the states to be open. My kids would love to go back to work. They're tired of being home. They're hard workers. They're not ones that can sit on their butt. And it would be wonderful to be able to go out to dinner with my husband and actually sit in a restaurant. But it's not worth dying over. And, you know, we've been shut down for 30 days, maybe 45 days in some places. And the people are barely following the rules as it is. You go to Walmart and people are walking around. Nobody's got masks. Nobody's got gloves on. I mean, I do. And a handful of people do. But they walk around. You're standing right on top of you. So we've already got fools that aren't doing what they're supposed to do.
Exactly.
They go ahead and open this state up, and we are going to go back to square one and lose everything we've gained. And, they want to get the businesses open. Obviously, they want the economy back, but it's not going to come back if we're all dead. You know, it doesn't make sense. We're finally gaining a little bit of ground on this. And so now they're going to reverse everything and put us all back into the melting pot again. And, you know, we've got issues. Now, that being said, should they open up the rest of these businesses if they did it with stipulations? Such as keep in place stores open for X amount of time, you know, and keep the mask and the glove. That would be great. And if they're going to open the rest of these stores that are non-essential, have it a limited time. You know, you go in certain stores, and they will count how many people go in and whether or not they're standing close together. We have a Walmart neighborhood market, which is not the big super. We have the super center in the neighborhood market. And in the neighborhood market, they stand out there and they won't let you in until they see the person in front of you is a good 25, 30 feet in the store. Then they'll let one more person in. And if you're caught standing on top of everybody in that store, you're asked to leave. So if they want to put those kind of policies out and open up the surrounding stores, I think that's fantastic. I don't think that allowing everybody to go into restaurants and sitting on top of each other is a good idea, or any some of these other places where they're all on top of each other. If they can think of a way to somewhat control that, you know, like everybody else, I'd love to see everybody back to work. But you've got to be realistic on what you're doing. Now, right now they haven't said there's any special restrictions. They're just going to go ahead and let everybody go back to the way it was. That obviously doesn't work. That's why we're in the situation we're in now.
Yeah.
Well,
I think you're right. Yes, Tony?
I have issues with Walmart anyway. They've shut all the mom and pop stores down here in Kentucky. And they're allowing Walmart to stay open instead of, you know, we'll just use clothing, for example. You have a mom-and-pop clothing store downtown that's been deemed non-essential, and they do curbside.
Yeah, they're shut down.
But
yeah, my daughter works for Carter's, same thing.
With Walmart, you can go in, and it's not roped off. It's not like, okay, here's the food, here's the pharmacy, you can't go past this. They're open for business, you know. And with the stimulus money, the only people we've helped is Wall Street. We've not helped mom and pop that can't weather the storm.
Right.
You know, the travesty that I'm seeing with all this is they're putting, when we come out of the end of the tunnel, how many of these folks have they put out of business and not offered any help or try, you know, and they want to pile debt on them. Like, oh, you can go to the SBA and borrow money, you know.
Yep, then they got to pay it back.
Then they got to pay it back.
Just like,
well, here's
what a loan does.
But this is where I have the problem with it. And I agree with Tony 110%. It's shutting down all these mom-and-pop stores. But yet they'll let Walmart stay open. Now, my problem is they're going to let Walmart stay open in the first week they had restrictions on being in Walmart. They did it. Now they're not. There's nobody standing at the supercenter. They're not watching. People shouldn't be allowed in there without their mask and gloves on. If they don't have a mask and glove, then they can either go get one or they can, you know, have it available to them. They're making their employees wear them, which is a good thing. But the rest of us, when we go in, like I go in and I look, you know, like a lunatic because I've got a mask and gloves on. And out of 100 people, there might be 15 other people that do.
Well,
you know?
That's true. You need to wear your mask and gloves, but I'm going to give you – I went in the bank the other day with that, and I locked and made it out. There was some policemen come up and because of the mask, but I got out okay, so I'm not – no, I'm kidding.
But I just think that they're shutting the mom and pop stores down. Now, and like my daughter, she works for Carter's Children Clothing. She is a very hardworking girl. She works, you know, 40-plus hours a week. She doesn't like the fact she's sitting home doing nothing. Now, I want everybody to be able to go back and earn a paycheck. I absolutely do. But let's do it smart. Let's have some regulations.
Right.
Let's have some stipulations for it. These mom-and-pop stores, they should be open. They're serving food. It's like a gas station. Gas stations are open because they've got gas. Mom-and-pop stores,
right,
you know, for that aren't any different. Give them, you know, between maybe, you know, 9 and 5 that they can be open. So they're not losing their life, you know, work over nothing.
And in the gas stations, a lot of the gas stations sell food, and, you know, have a little hot bar deal or grill inside. you go in the gas station, you get your gas, you go in, you pay for your gas, go, oh, I'll have an order of chicken tenders and fries. And
yeah.
There's no difference of you doing that. And then how many people are wearing gloves whenever, I mean, how many people touch the pump that day? You know, I mean, we got to come up with a way that is enforceable, because I think
open up the stores. I'm all for that, but let's have it controlled. Let's have regulations. If they can have those kinds of regulations at Walmart, even though they don't follow them, and the grocery stores, we can do that with the other businesses. You know, whether it be Carter's. Or like my son, he works for a boat company. He works on boat engines, you know, that type of thing. Whoever, the small mom-and-pop stores, let them have their businesses. But let's do it and have a controlled area, just like they're trying to do with some of the grocery stores that don't follow the law.
And I tell you what,
Robin,
you are right. And you know what? I noticed that our guest has come back in. Scott, are you back with us? Scott, are you back with us?
Apparently he's only mind speaking.
Yeah, I need to get out the spirit box. I mean that you sound like me.
That's exactly right. Hey, now Devin, are you still
maybe
with
he's using mental telepathy?
I am. That's right.
You are. I mean, you know, it's interesting. He appeared back here on my control panel without me bringing him in. Were you able to get a hold of him and see if everything's okay?
I sent him a text, but I haven't heard back.
Okay, well, he apparently showed back up, and now we still can't talk to him. That's terrible. All right, well, I tell you what, we're going to keep on. This is some great conversation about coronavirus, and we're waiting for Scott to get back with us. It's kind of weird. It's, I guess it's
too bad it
wasn't
talking about the other corona. Too bad the other corona.
So I'm sorry, Robin. Can you please... Can you please continue to give us, you know, finish up that thought, because that was important.
Well, like I said, I'm not an expert on any of this stuff. This is just my own opinion, but I think there's a way to, you know, open the states up but keep certain things restricted. Like Florida's allowing them back in the ocean. I mean, who in the hell thought that was a good idea? I have no idea. But I mean, as far as the stores, obviously the stores and the restaurants need the income. They need people to come back in. But be smart about it. Have the restrictions. You know, I don't think in my heart of hearts it's safe for everybody to be dining in. I think that's a really bad idea. But, you know, whatever. But if they can make restrictions and like Dollar General, that's an essential store. The grocery store, it's essential. The gas stations, Walmart, that kind of thing. They can also let the mom-and-pop shops. They can also let the clothing shops and everything else. They just have to have restrictions on what and how to do it. But if they're not going to enforce those restrictions, it doesn't do anybody any good. It's like with Walmart. They started out with a bang. They were very vigilant on making sure there was only so many people in there, and they patrolled it to make sure nobody was on top of each other, encouraged everybody to wear the mask and the gloves. Now it's a free-for-all. I mean, it's just ridiculous.
And now, I believe, and Robin, we'll continue this in a little bit. Scott, do we have you back?
Hello, yes, I'm here. Hi.
We're so glad you're here.
God.
I'm sorry for the technical difficulty, but here I am. So thank you very much for welcoming me aboard.
Absolutely.
Yeah,
we were just waiting on you. And Murder 123, we discussed murder, mayhem, terrorism with our friends. And you know what? There's no better thing to do. And you're a friend of Devin Tate's, who has been one of our stalwart panelists. I guess for 3 years I've known Devin, and it's been a pleasure to know him. And he told me he had this friend, Scott, who runs tours over in Los Angeles. And one of the tours that he runs is the Charles Manson tour, correct?
That's correct, yes.
And so tell us a little bit about your company, and tell us about Charles Manson, because last week we talked about Robbie Beausoleil, who was Manson's
mm-hmm.
go-to boy, and he
mm-hmm.
was responsible for several dastardly murders. So tell us, if you don't mind, give us the story that you have about Charles Manson. Is that okay?
Sure. Yeah. Well, I mean, about 8 or 9 years ago, we released a film called The 6 Degrees of Helter Skelter, and it's a geographic retelling of the crimes. We tried to get away from the focus of Manson solely. That's why we call the tour the Helter Skelter Tour, because my company, what we do is very victim-oriented. So I do try to not refer to them as the Manson murders, just out of respect to the victims. But
okay.
Obviously, it's, you know, we're here we are 50 plus years later talking about it. My company has been around for 15 years, and we do what's called the Tragical History Tour. It's a 3-hour sort of lighthearted look at the dark side of Hollywood. And once I got the tour company going, I decided to branch out and do other tours. So I literally had pins in a map. This is long before Google Earth, of all the different locations that I thought were relevant enough. And I had enough of the Tate-LaBianca information to merit doing a tour. And then my friend Mike Dorsey reached out and asked if I would co-produce and make this documentary called The 6 Degrees. And so we tried to stay away from the theories so much as the, you know, just trying to say this is where it happened, this is what exactly happened, instead of why did this happen, you know. Because
yeah.
You can go on for weeks with all of that information without taking a break.
Well, absolutely. Yeah. And I can tell you that I would rate the Manson, the murders that Charles Manson participated in and directed to be one of the most heinous set of crimes in the history of the United States. We've discussed monsters like H.H. Holmes, who killed who knows how many people. We've talked
right.
about some people that Devin knew as a kid who murdered people. But, you know, the Tate LaBianca murders and the whole thing that involved Charles Manson is truly unbelievable. It's a very, very dark spot on Hollywood, which was a pretty cool place until that happened. And then people started looking at it and said, well, there is a dark side, you know. And then when you get there's so many other entertainers that have been drawn into that dark side or have been part of it. So do you want to give us a little bit of give us the background or give us the story, if you don't mind?
Sure. Well, I always say that the Tate LaBianca murders I will refer to them in conversation as the Manson murders because that's the way we've been taught. But they sort of changed. They changed so very much in history around the world, certainly in America and possibly around the world, because people all around the world are obsessed with the case. And it changed things so much so that, you know, our personal comfort level was gone after this. You were no longer safe literally in your own bed. And that became really terrifying. People didn't have, you know, bars on their windows yet. People, you know, crowded around the television on Saturday nights and watched, you know, primetime shows. And now people were, you know, seemingly randomly murdered, you know, in their homes, you know, or in their pajamas or you know, it just disrupted things so completely because of the, you know, the terror, the seemingly nonsensical random acts. And also the fact that it went unsolved for 4 months. No one was charged for 4 months. So, you know, you were locking your doors and windows and buying guns and burglar alarms and dogs. And, you know, so safety was gone at that point. You know, the 60s, before the Tate LaBianca murders, you know, there were other things that happened that were pretty horrific, obviously Kennedy and things like that. And other things did happen after the murders, like Woodstock, you know, happened 1 week after the Tate LaBianca murders. So there were still other things to happen in the 60s, but it certainly Manson and those murders tied it up with a bow, and the 60s were, you know, officially over because it was the end of the 60s, and mentally over because of, you know, hippies couldn't even trust themselves after this happened. They couldn't trust each other.
Yeah.
Well, that's true because, and I can't remember the fellow's name, the guy that produced Woodstock. I had the pleasure of hanging out with him for about a week at a major sporting event. Oh, it was probably 20 years ago. And that's what he said. He said, you know, when I was a kid and I was producing Woodstock, everybody loved each other. Everyone trusted each other. There was no equivocation that there would ever be a problem. But, you know, we apparently grew right out of Woodstock and right into the dastardly 70s, 80s, and 90s, and that's where we are. We are where we are now. So, can you tell us?
Yeah, what is fascinating about this is that, you know, Manson was as much a part of the 60s music scene as anyone else was. So, Mama Cass's home in Laurel Canyon was a, you know, sort of the center point of that, you know, Crosby, Stills, and Nash, and the Doors and the Mamas and the Papas. They all lived in that neighborhood, and her home was a party pad. And nobody was at the gates checking IDs. You know, it was come and go as you please. And back then, you wouldn't know the difference between Dennis Hopper and Charles Manson, you know, from behind, except, you know, Manson was only 5'4", and most everyone else was taller than him. But, you know, so Manson could go in and out of these places, you know, on a whim and wouldn't even raise an eyebrow. Or if he did, he was a curiosity and he was welcomed in because he had drugs and he had kooky girls. So people would say, hey, man, check this guy out with the guitar. Let him in. And he'd sit down and start playing. And the girls, you know, Atkins, they'd start writhing around, you know, and it was a bizarre spectacle. So he was welcomed in that scene. And that was what was even more freaky to the people of that era in Los Angeles, because they, a lot of them knew him, you know. Peter Fonda, I'm 100% positive, knew Manson and Dennis Hopper. And Mama Cass's boyfriend was in cahoots with Manson and Wojciech Frykowski. And so the reach is wide, which is why we called our documentary The 6 Degrees of Helter Skelter, because, you know, within 4 degrees, you could probably connect the Pope, you know, to Sharon Tate or Roman Polanski. And it's just such a bizarre thing. And so many pop culture references, the Beach Boys, et cetera, can be linked back to these people.
I mean, yeah, we talked about last time that Manson wrote one of the songs that the Beach Boys performed, and it was like the B-side, and I'm not right now, I can't remember which song, but one of their major releases, one of his songs was on the B-side. Incredible. He's a good song. Great songwriter.
Yeah, it's still there. I Never Learn Not to Love. Manson wrote it and called it Cease to Exist. The Beach Boys recorded it because Dennis Wilson was sort of doing it as a favor, because Manson, he kind of smiled upon Manson, and Manson, you know, Manson wasn't untalented. Manson wasn't a bad singer. He wasn't particularly good either. But, you know, there were a lot of people with one album or one single that were out back then, and Dennis Wilson, you know, Manson was plying him with drugs and women, and he was inebriated most of the time, and Manson, he thought, well, what the hell? I'll, maybe this guy's got an album in him. So he introduced him to Terry Melcher, and then he moved in with Dennis Wilson and ripped off Dennis Wilson. And, you know, so that's why when the Beach Boys recorded that song and put it on their 2020 album, they gave the songwriting credit to Dennis Wilson, because Manson stole so much money from them and destroyed so much of his personal property. They figured, you know, Dennis could recoup his losses that way.
Really?
That feels fine. Blank.
Yeah, we did not know this. Now, this is pretty interesting.
I'm having a real. I'm losing your voices.
I'm sorry. So what I was saying is that information about everything that he stole from Dennis Wilson, that's part of your tour, correct?
Well, it's certainly conversationally part of it. We cover in our tour is 45 miles, and we do that in 4 hours. So there's a lot of information. And when we go to, of course, both the locations where the murders occurred, but we go to where you know J.C. Bring used to live, where they threw the clothes out the window of the car that night, the bloody clothes, and where they threw the or where they hosed off in the driveway, and where the gun was found. So we cover a lot of ground on that tour. So we touch on the Beach Boys thing for a few minutes, but we try to stay pretty closely to the just the murders, but conversationally, since we're passing other places, we mention them too. Like we pass Paramount Studios, and it's like, well, that's where Polanski was taken when he got back to Los Angeles when he got the news. He couldn't go home because his home was a crime scene, so Robert Evans, his friend, put him on the Paramount lot, because it was behind locked gates, and he could protect him. So it's just fascinating. Again, Paramount Studios, which was filming the first episode of the Brady Bunch that week, and Roman Polanski was holed up there, which is it just, you know what I mean? Just the bizarre kind of reaches of this this pop culture-wise is bizarre. They were filming the first episode of the Brady Bunch the week of the murders, and Roman was on the set on the lot. Anyway, I digress. I'm sorry. I apologize.
No, that's okay. I mean, you're talking about the director and perpetrator of one of my favorite films, which is Rosemary's Baby. And I mean, good Lord, anything we can find out about Rosemary's Baby, and it was just unbelievable. So anyway, we talked about when Robbie Beausoleil committed that murder. Robbie and a girl.
Bruce Davis was there, Mary Brunner was there, Susan Atkins was there, but it was Bobby that that actually stabbed him, yeah, and the girl suffocated him.
Wow.
Back and forth and forth and back, along with the fact that they tortured him for at least 2 days, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes, yeah.
Yeah,
Manson was not a dumb guy. So, you know, Bobby Beausoleil, who really wasn't a follower of Manson's, but he was a pal of Manson's, and he hung around with Manson, and his girlfriend was Leslie Van Houten for a long time. And Bobby was sort of used, because he was the cute one, to collect girls. But he was more of a friend of Manson's, and he owed Manson a favor. And Manson, there's a couple of theories as to why, but Manson sent him to Gary Hinman's house to get either, you know, money compensation for drugs or money that he heard that he had. So he did that as a debt to Manson to go and collect this money. And when there wasn't any money, you know, Bobby Beausoleil was beating up Gary Hinman, and there was no money, and Bobby didn't know what to do. So he called Manson, and Manson shows up, and he's angry because he didn't want to be involved. And he walked in the room, and he had a machete, I think it was, and he smashed Hinman on the side of the head with this machete, splitting open his head. So Gary Hinman is screaming, and blood is squirting, and the girls that are there are screaming because they'd not been around any of this stuff before. So Manson says, "I'm out of here." But before he left, he said to Bobby, "You know what to do." So he never told anyone to kill anyone that night, literally did not tell them, but he made it quite clear what he wanted done. You know what to do. So that was, you know, that's how Manson got away with it. He said, he'd say, "I never told anybody to kill anybody." It's quite likely he didn't, but he made it clear what he wanted done. But he wasn't a dumb guy. So he just kept his nose clean, you know. "I never told anyone," but he made it clear.
What a master at delegating authority. Wow.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah, yeah.
He knew what he was doing, so he didn't have to incriminate himself.
Exactly.
Right.
But this is not a skilled
operation. This wasn't something that was thought out. These guys were flying by the seat of their pants. Manson, you know, when you call Manson's family a cult, it's sort of weird because Manson wasn't like that kind of a guy. He wasn't like a religious leader, though he liked being a leader, but everything that he taught these girls or anyone that followed him could be traced back to other sources. Like, you know, a lot of people don't know, there's another cult not very far from the Spahn Ranch called a Fountain of the World, and it's still there today. And they call themselves a dominion or something, where they're protected by the government, or they're not. Rather, they have nothing to do with the government, no mail delivery, etc. But they're still there. And the guy who founded that, Krishna Venti was his name, had all these really racist philosophies and how, you know, the guys had 20 wives, etc. And Manson stayed there for a while, long before the murders, and he sort of collected that information from there and made it his own. So a lot of that helter-skelter business, which is largely, you know, sort of put together by the prosecutor to convict Manson, but a lot of Manson's own, you know, putting himself on a cross, etc., that was all stuff that he gathered from other organizations. He just sort of collected, you know, used what he could from the things that he learned, and to his benefit. So, you know, Manson, he was never, I don't know, he ever saw himself as a religious leader. He was just a con man. And he saw, and when he got out of prison in 67, and he went to Haight-Ashbury, and he saw these gurus and these guys on the corners playing, you know, their guitars and people following him, he thought, "Well, I could get into this." And it just went, it just snowballed. I mean, it was crazy. But there was no big conspiracy. There was no big plan. They were just winging it.
How did Manson and the others make money? Were they heavy into drug dealing, or how did they provide for themselves?
Well, a lot of it was stealing. You know, a lot of people, they literally shoplifted. In fact, I think it was Sandra Good and Lynette from Squeaky. They probably would have been there on the nights of the murders, but they were in jail for, I think, forging or using credit cards, et cetera, that didn't belong to them. But I think that's why Van Houten went and Kasabian went, because those two were locked up for something else. So they all had, you know, crime sheets of, you know, rap sheets, I guess. But it was mostly through, you know, shoplifting and drug dealing, et cetera. I'm sure some of them had, they were runaways. Their parents would send these kids money, and they would give the money straight to Manson. So there was never any real legit work going on there. It was all sort of, you know, again, flying by the seat of their pants. The Spahn Ranch was horseback riding. That's how the ranch stayed afloat. So maybe they worked for him as well, for George Spahn. But there was no steady employment for any of these people. It was probably just drugs and theft.
I see Manson as a master manipulator.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, he was good at it. He knew how to get what he wanted from people, and he knew how to push their buttons. That's the thing. Because when these girls, you know, were joining up with them, they weren't like, oh, Charlie, you're a god yet. But Charlie would give them acid, and he'd orchestrate these orgies so they would have to do things that made them very uncomfortable, and he kept them so wasted all the time. And then he knew the way psychedelics work. So while they were tripping, he put himself on a cross in front of a fire, and they were hallucinating. They thought they saw flames coming out of his eyeballs and his fingertips, and he would speak in circles. He would say things like, you know, no sense makes sense, always is, all is forever. And when you're, you know, when you're wasted and somebody's talking like that, especially on psychedelics, you start thinking that, wow, this guy maybe is a god. And, you know, when they were really down, that's when he got them convinced to do the weird things that they did. So, yes, you're right, an absolute master manipulator. He knew how to get what he wanted from people. Another issue, you know, Patricia Kremlingel.
It's like deprogramming and programming all over again, right?
Right, exactly. And he picked up these girls, and it's true. He said, I picked up these runaways that you threw away, and I took them in. And that's the absolute truth. He did do that. Mm-hmm. He just, what he did mm-hmm. with them was pretty bad. Yeah. And he would hit their buttons, you know, while they were tripping. You know, Patricia Kremlingel wasn't... She was born with a condition where she had a lot of body hair. She was in her late teens. She came from a broken mm-hmm. family. This is the 60s. Manson's giving her acid and telling her she's the most beautiful person in the world and makes love to her. So she's like, this man's a god. I love him, you know? And the other one he did this to, and the other one he did that to. So he knew which buttons to push.
And he probably picked a lot of that up in prison, and from an early age, you know, when you read into his background, you know, he was in and out of institutions from a very early age, and he's probably picked up a lot of that. You know, him being 5'4", to survive in prison, he's had to use his wits a lot, you know, and learn how to work people. And then when
I mean, if he didn't act like a crazy person, he'd have been eaten alive in prison. You know, that's how he got people to, you know, be freaked out by him. That jumping around and hovering around like he did and saying the things that he did, that was how he survived. That was a survival instinct, most definitely. Because in his 83 years, he'd only been on the outside for 15 of them. So, you know, detention centers and prisons were his life, and he didn't know anything any different.
How much older was Manson than like, Tex Watson and the rest of them?
A good 10 years at least. You know, a lot of the girls, when they were late teens, Charlie was in his early 30s. So most, you know, but they were late teens to, I would say, mid to late 20s. And that's the other thing he had on him, too, the generation gap. Because remember, I don't know how old you are, but when I was growing up, I was born in the early 60s. And it didn't matter who it was. If they were older than you, you respected them. They were your elders.
Yeah.
And it didn't matter, you know, if they were the most evil people in the world, you had to call them sir or ma'am and follow their orders. So that was another mm-hmm. part of the scenario with those girls, is that, you know, he was like a father figure, literally as the in age and the way he behaved towards them.
Right, right. And father figure / authority figure, because whenever that he's manipulating them, he's like you said, he when he walks out of the first murder, he's saying, you know what needs to be done. And so mm-hmm. Manson's been in the joint, and he's not going to put his hands on it. That's what, and that, to me, that's one of the reasons that I think he developed these folks up, these Tex Watson and Atkins and the rest of them, to do, I don't want to say bidding, but that's what they were doing. And he used them to settle, either get him what he needed, use them as a vehicle to get what he needed, or to take care of maybe a beef he had with somebody, like with maybe the murders. Do you think that he knew that Terry Melcher was not at that residence that night, or do you think he sent them thinking Terry Melcher was there?
No, absolutely not. No, he knew Melcher didn't live there, because about 5 months before the murders, Manson went up there to confront Terry Melcher, and Sharon was home, and her photographer opened up the front door. And Manson was familiar with the property, so after this photographer told Manson to get lost, Manson went back to the back house, the guest house, where the owner of the property was staying, Rudolph Altobelli. And Altobelli knew Manson, too. He goes, what do you want, Charlie? He says, I came to see Terry. Well, Terry lives in Malibu now, and didn't give Manson Terry's address on purpose. So Manson left knowing, you know, full well that Melcher didn't live there anymore, and that he didn't know who she was, but that Sharon Tate did, just a beautiful, you know, Hollywood type.
Right, so he picked that place maybe just because he was familiar with the address instead of
being there's another 3-hour conversation we could have. But there is a lot of information regarding different motivations to why Manson went up to that house and had them do the things they did. Some people think that Wojciech Frykowski was in business with them and burned him on a drug deal. There's a lot of evidence to support that. In fact, I that's what I'm on board with. You know, that Wojciech Frykowski was involved in the drug business, possibly Abigail Folger, possibly Jay Sebring, but I'm 100% positive myself personally that Wojciech Frykowski had dealings with Manson and certainly Tex Watson.
What's your thoughts on Tex Watson?
Tex is just an animal. I mean, he was a, I wouldn't even call him a follower of Manson. He was like a rabid dog, a robot, just a killing machine. Because on those two mm-hmm. nights, you know, Manson wasn't there when anyone died. It's never been proven ever that Manson killed anyone, although we know he's tried to, so it's probably true. But Tex Watson is responsible for the mutilation of 6 of those 7 victims, killing 6 of those 7 people, but to the point of, you know, literally overkill. I mean, Wojciech Frykowski had 51 stab wounds. You know, Rosemary LaBianca had 41. And that's all down to Tex and carving war into Mr. LaBianca's stomach. You know, Tex was a lunatic. And so I do think that that's very interesting to look at. I don't want to open up too many conversations here because I could go on and on. But the LaBiancas were not random crimes either, because Manson was very familiar with the house next door, as was Tex, as was Susan Atkins. They'd all hung out at the house next door, and there's all sorts of theories about, you know, why Manson chose that house that night at the LaBiancas. But Manson was very familiar with the property, certainly, at least.
Absolutely. And, you know, I want to say this because I think this is important, and I never thought about it until you just said it. You said the phrase,
okay, you just went dead for me. Sorry. I missed what you said.
Let me ask you, did you say the phrase father figure, correct?
Yes.
Okay. Well, you know, there was a billion-selling number one song by George Michael called Father Figure, and I just read the lyrics. And it's very interesting what the lyrics say. You know, they say, I'll be your father figure, put your hand in mine. I'll be your preacher, teacher. Anything you have in mind, I'll be your father figure. I have had a lot of crime. I will be the one that loves you until the end of time. You know, God, you read those lyrics and you say, well, how influenced was this gigantic song by George Michael? That sounds like right out of the Charles Manson world, doesn't it?
It could do. I mean, is it the same for David Koresh? Is it the same for the Creepy Heaven's Gate guys? You know, I don't know, because I don't know much about those organizations. But
yeah.
Manson is my thing, and it certainly pegs it. Certainly does. Right, nail on the head. Certainly describes, yeah, the way he was.
Well, I'm telling you, as soon as you said the word father figure, I said, I need to check these lyrics out. So I guess what I can say is, whether it's subliminally or it's just reality, the Manson murders have permeated our society farther than anything. I mean, they just have. Don't you think?
Well, as I said before, I mean, it's our comfort level. Psychologically, we are no longer comfortable in our homes because of that, I do think. And yeah, he's a reference point. And what I find fascinating is one of the many things I found fascinating about this. When people describe evil, they always say Adolf Hitler and Charles Manson, always. And here's a point to remember. Roman Polanski, his family were killed during the death camps, and his wife was killed as a result of Manson. So the two most evil, you know, entities that people refer to were both involved with murdering Roman Polanski's immediate family. I think that's a really fascinating thing.
Well, it really is. And it'd be interesting to see what people today say if you ask who are the most evil people of all time. You know, what I can tell you is probably, depending on who you say, you'd get the two names Donald Trump and Nancy Pelosi. You probably would today because of the media and what we have been spoon-fed by CNN, MSNBC, and Fox News. And it's amazing how our perception has changed. But, you know, this has been a really wonderful look at what went on in the past, because we do have, you know, some of the finest panelists and some of the smartest people I've ever known. I would like for each, if you don't mind, Scott, to ask you a question so that we can kind of, you know, I'd like for them to have their important questions answered from you. Now, Robin McRae, Robin is a dear friend. She is a paranormalist. She is a Bigfoot habituator, meaning she understands the nature and the family aspect of Bigfoot, and she's a remote viewer and one of the dearest friends I've ever had. So I just want to give you background on everybody before they ask you, so you'll kind of understand the, I guess, where they're coming from. So, Robin, what question do you have for Scott about the issue of Charles Manson?
I don't necessarily know that I have a question. I'm finding absolutely everything he says fascinating. It's wonderful to listen to you, Scott. Try to pick up a little bit off of him, and I tell you what, this is one really creepy guy. I mean, we already know how bad he is, but I'm just saying, he is literally creepy. Like, his mental state, he's highly intelligent to begin with. I mean, really and truly intelligent, which is how he manipulated everybody. But his way he processes things is very bizarre. It's very bizarre. I mean, he's got to have some serious mental illness going on in there. And, you know, we already know that a lot of people with mental illnesses are actually some of the most intelligent people we have.
Yeah.
And in his case, it's disturbing and it's creepy. Like, I tried to see if he would say anything, and he has this wicked, awful laugh. And there's so much rage coming off of him. Not even, you know, you would think there would be more hate, and there really isn't a lot of hate coming off of him. He's overconfident to the point that he's cocky.
Yeah, he is. I mean, you know, see, he was he's a victim or a product, we'll say, of the punishment system of the, you know, incarceration.
Yeah, and he just feels that he was in the right. Like, he still doesn't feel like he has done anything wrong.
I'll say, you know, I have a friend who was very close to Charles Manson, and until Manson died, I wouldn't even speak to these people. I could not deal with it. To me, it's like, now that he's gone off the earth, I can have a rational conversation about the man. Before,
yeah,
I wouldn't even entertain it. And my friend who was very close to Manson, it's been fascinating to listen to him, because Manson, you know, he would describe his time with Manson, and Manson liked listening to Aretha Franklin and things like that. It was things that gave me a little bit of a peek into Manson as a human being.
My friend who knew
Manson would say things to him. You know, his interest was, of course, the Tate LaBianca murders. And Manson, for some reason, granted him an audience to visit him in prison, and they became very good friends. And he would talk, and Manson would just talk. He'd just talk, and people would listen, because that's what happens with famous people, be them bad or good. If you go up to somebody that's famous, they could just just rattle off their laundry list, and you just listen because they're so compelling, and you want to please them, and you want to like them, and you want to hear them.
Like I said, to do a read on him, I would have expected to pick up anger and hate and all this. And I really and truly, not that, you know, a little bit of anger isn't there, I didn't get, like a lot of the ones that we talk about on this show, they're so filled with anger and hate for other people. That's not really the case that I'm getting off of him. I'm really surprised. I'm getting a cockiness. He is thrilled by the attention that he's gotten. That seems to excite him. You know, at some point he's somewhat playful. He feels like he's almost got this godlike presence in his own mind. And the entire world is out here to be his followers.
Mm-hmm. And he had them, and tenfold. I mean, people wrote him every day. And it's funny because my friend, when he first visited Manson had like a litmus. He would talk to, when he met somebody, he'd try to figure him out straight away. And if you were so fortunate to get an audience with him, and I think that's the way he looked at it, he would meet you and he'd say something like, I'm going to call you Blue Wolf or something like that. He'd make up some name. And most people would go away going, ooh, I'm cool, I'm a member of the family. He gave me a funny name. And my friend who he did that to, he says, well, I have a name, and I'm happy with that. I don't need your name. And then Manson was sort of taken aback by that. So I think Manson did the whole godlike thing, but he also, I think if people would have pushed back on him, I think that he would have crumbled pretty quickly. But people didn't do that.
The only thing he did say is he kind of laughed. He's got a weird, weird, really creepy laugh. And he's like, nobody will ever forget me. I'm not forgettable. Nobody will forget me. But it's not, he isn't saying it in the form that you would think it's because of all the things that they're remembering. It's because he feels truly that once he was in the presence of someone, he was the Almighty. And that's why people won't forget him. It's really bizarre. It's not what you would get. Like when we've done other murders on this show, and some of them have talked, some of them haven't, but I can get a read on them anyway. And like with him, at first he didn't want to talk until he just said that. But it's all ego-based, everything. Like I have a whole new idea in my head as far as why he did the things that he did. It is literally ego-based. It wasn't like a lot of these killers that it's, I hate women because my mommy did this, or I, you know, it is strictly an ego, and he feels like whatever went on in his childhood, he survived it, and he's tougher because of it, but now he is the one that everybody should come to. It's like, you know, he's a messiah or something, and he just has that way to manipulate everything, but it doesn't come from hatred and anger like a lot of these people do, as much as it really and truly is ego-based.
Yeah, I do think that Manson, he was given that power by others. And if he wasn't given that power by you, he had no use for you. So there was, he collected people, and he collected the people that wouldn't push back.
He surrounded the people that were going to cater to what he emotionally felt he deserved.
Right.
And everybody else was just not worthy.
Yeah, or he didn't care because he couldn't get anything from them, right? So yeah, done with you. He kicked a lot of people off the ranch for that reason, yeah.
Yeah, it's wonderful listening to you. The insight and what you know is fantastic.
Oh, it's very kind of you. Thank you. I since I haven't been working in several weeks, it's sort of nice to tap my brain for a change, which is probably why I'm not shutting up. Sorry about
that. Well, no, we want you to talk. That's great. And we appreciate you so much.
It's a story that will never go away. I used to think that after Deborah Tate, Sharon's sister, died, that these people would, and the murderers, because of all of them, Susan Atkins and Manson are dead now, but there are still so many of the, quote, family members around. But once this generation dies out, that the murders would die out. But then Once Upon a Time in Hollywood coming out, Tarantino immortalized these people. And history is... will be remembered differently, and I hope that the people that watch that movie will delve a little bit further into the genuine case and see what really did happen back then. But those people are going to go down in history because people will be studying Tarantino movies until, forever, like Hitchcock.
Right. Yeah, well, the thing of it is, he's got just millions of followers now.
Yeah.
Yeah,
have you looked into any of that stuff, AWA, the ATWA stuff?
No, this is the thing. It's so comical that I'm on this Murder 123, which I love, and I'm grateful to be here. I have never been a big murder buff. I haven't. So when I come into these shows that we're doing, I'm as cold turkey as anybody can be because I don't know any of this stuff. I truly don't. And so which is good because then when they communicate me and when I try to do a read on them, it's not plugged up with other information. It's about as fresh as it can get because it's on something that I literally couldn't give you any information about. But he really and truly, he's like so cocky. Like now he's like right there and I can hear him. And he's like, if I came back to life right now, I could start right where I left off.
Well, yeah, Manson was whomever you wanted him to be or whoever you needed him to be. And people like that sort of Life magazine, crazy-eyed photograph of Manson. And so they give him that power. Manson would step right back into it, most definitely.
He's verbal about it. He's like, he's saying this to me. He says, I can make you be anything I want you to be.
Mm-hmm.
And I think he had that power.
Yeah, he was full of it, and he knew he was full of it.
Ultra cocky.
Yeah.
And he's like, if I could come back right now, he said, the trouble I could cause, and he just starts laughing.
But he was just a little common. That's the thing about him. When he did that interview, when he said, I'd kill 400 or 500 of you people. He was just full of it. I mean, Manson didn't have the nerve to kill anybody, and really, he tried to, but he didn't do it. So he was just this little runt of a guy who knew what he could get away with, and people give him that superhero, crazy villain label that he steps up to.
Oh, yeah, and he's like, the women love me. He says, the women love me. I could get a woman to do anything I wanted her to do, is what
he
said.
He certainly did, yeah.
He's
a charming guy.
He really is, But he said there was no need for him to do it. He said, I had too many followers that would do anything I told them to do. And, when you were talking, it's very clear that he was such a, Tony was talking, he's a master manipulator. So when he did this, the way he worded it excluded him from guilt.
Mm-hmm.
It really did. I mean, they knew what he wanted to do, and that's what they executed. But the verbiage that he used removed him from guilt, which would make it excessively hard to prosecute.
Right. Yeah. When these people were tripping, he would have them repeat, I am Charlie, you are Charlie, we are all one, I am God, I am man's son, the son of man, Jesus Christ. But he would never say, I am you. He'd say, you are Charlie, I am Charlie, but he would never say, I am you, because that would be giving him, lessening his authority over them. So he was, he was just a negative. Yeah.
Oh, my goodness. But
it's fascinating, and here we are, 50-something years later.
I think it'll always continue. I don't see it ever going away.
No. No, if, I mean, really, if you were very interested, there are several Facebook groups devoted to this, and Manson's own, you know, AQUA, which is his own organization, Air, Trees, Water, Animals, and that was what Manson sort of founded, or his followers did. But there are lots of organizations online that, you know, claim to be experts on it, and they all hate each other's guts, and it's become a really an interesting phenomena too, because people take ownership of this case as if it's their own, and they forget in the big picture that there are seven people plus many more that have suffered death because of this case, and it's not about you. And that's what's quite sad about it, is so many people have made this case about them, and they forget the big picture. There are real victims and real families.
Wow. And we just hear, is that a clock we're hearing chiming back?
Yeah, I'm sorry. The bell is tolling.
No, it's perfect. So what I wanted to tell you.
Oh, you know what? Here's something that's kind of interesting. I'm a real nerd when it comes to this case. And I went to the library to find out what was showing on television the night of the LaBianca murders. And while the LaBiancas were being murdered, the movie For Whom the Bell Tolls was playing on television.
Oh, wow.
Really? Wow. You know, just amazing. And I didn't want to tell you this, and I want to compliment all of my co-hosts. I have the most literate co-hosts in the world. I handpicked them. They're all my friends, but I'm lucky enough to have this bunch of friends. Robin is a marvelous remote viewer, and she's a little bit on the psychic side, and I have found that she is usually, in fact, I've never found her not to be, and that's amazing. So, Robin, I mean, first of all, those were 10 thoughts that you had. Next person that I would like to introduce you to is Papa Stro, the maestro of wrestling. Yeah, you'd think this is just a wrestler. Well, first of all, this is one of the most accomplished wrestlers I know. He is the toughest man. I believe he's one of the toughest men on the planet. And he's brilliant. And he knows human psychology better than anyone I know. Pop Drove, what conversation would you like to have with Scott a little bit? What would you like to ask him about Charles Tate, Charles Manson, the Tate LaBianca murders, and everything? The floor, sir. No, the ring is yours.
Well, Scott, you brought some great talking points about Charles Manson and his way of manipulation. It's psychology 101. I mean, it reminds me of the interrogation tactics with George Orwell's novel 1984, where William Smith, who was the main protagonist, was going through the interrogation, which they were telling them 2 + 2 = 5, and basically forcing him to unthink what he had thought all those years, you know, existing on the earth, and then reprogramming him and plant new thoughts in his head, more or less. And it's just fascinating that all this came naturally to Charles Manson, the way he would manipulate people and get people to do his bidding, if you will. So, I mean, it's amazing how his psychology philosophy really paralleled with a lot of the interrogation tactics you see in, like, for example, 1984, or I've heard in various conspiracy theories 30 years.
Right. Now, he was – it's interesting because Manson was not – you know, I think Manson was borderline illiterate. I don't think he ever wrote a book in his life. Ever read a book in his
right.
life, sorry. And so the fact that he had the smarts to do what he did was pretty interesting. You know, like, brainwashing, it sounds like such a sophisticated, process. But Manson, you know, he was just winging it, and he knew what to do. And he could have probably been a great man, a great scientist maybe at some point, but he chose to use his talents or his charms for petty crimes, ultimately you know, resulting in what happened. But I mean, here's what's interesting. Okay, or one of the methods. You know, he would collect these girls. He would be, as I said, whomever you needed him to be. So he told Pat Kernwinkle that she was a beautiful girl, and mm-hmm. he told that he's. I forget what it was exactly that he used. Oh, Susan Atkins. He was quite provocative with her. And he knew that she was a stripper, and she turned tricks. And he walked up to her defiantly and said, "I am the god of FECK." You know, just and she's like, you know, she wanted that character, that person, that authoritative, that alpha. And he would collect these people, and then he would orchestrate these orgies, and he would have these girls do things that made them very uncomfortable while they were tripping. So, you know, Susan Atkins, well, they would have them, you know, sex with each other, the women, you know, whatever. It's just some people wanted to, some people didn't. But he made the people who didn't do it more. And it got to the mm-hmm. point where he was having, you know, these girls were having sex with 5 and 6 guys a day. I wouldn't even call it having sex. I would call it rape. And then Susan Atkins, while tripping, he demanded that she give, and forgive my graphic statement, but while Susan Atkins was tripping on acid, he made her give oral sex to her 6-month-old son. And so you could almost hear the snap, you know, in her head of the windows crashing down of her mind because of the explosion going in her mind, the psychological freak out. But this man told her to do that, and that just led to her blind loyalty to him. He knocked them down to the point where they were nothing and brought them back again. And that's pretty impressive for a guy that had no education.
Yeah, the fact that he can do that all naturally is really scary.
Yeah,
without any education,
right.
Not prior knowledge to it.
That's unbelievable. Absolutely unbelievable. Rob, thank you for those questions.
Thank you. It was nice to chat with you.
Thank you.
Some incredible answers. Now, the super-duper premier paranormal investigator in all of Kentucky on the East Coast, Tony Pelosi. What do you have to ask?
Scott, I have a two-point question. The first is more of a overview. Do you think that Tex Watson was trying to out Manson with his brutality? Do you think he had more aspirations than following Manson? Did he want to be Manson, do you think? And the second part of the question is, what is the relationship, what's your take on the relationship between Tex Watson and Atkins?
Well, I think that Tex was always going to be a soldier. I don't think Tex had it in him to be a leader. But I also think Tex was into it for himself. You know, I think he had a lot of sidelines. I think he had a lot of side businesses going on. And I don't think that he saw himself as taking over Manson's role at any time because he split, actually. When things got crazy, you know, Tex took off and went back to Texas before there was anyone charged with the murder, so they had to chase him down. So Tex was I just think he was like a robot. He was a soldier, complete guidance. You know, he would have been great in the military, and I'm no disrespect to anyone in the military, but he followed orders, and he was fine with that. But he was, I think he had some sideline businesses going on, and I think that, you know, I do think that he and Wojciech Frykowski had something going on, and I do think that might have caused one of the major reasons why he went up to the house that night. But there's also, you know, there's some really crazy relationships. How, you know, this is going to be a little bit, you know, opening up a can of worms that you probably didn't want to open up. But Mr. and Mrs. LaBianca, when they got home that night, they were away for the weekend, and they were away for that day. They were picking up their Mrs. LaBianca's children, and her daughter Susan was of the same age as the girls of the Manson family, was in the car with them, and they dropped her off at her house before they went back to their house, where they were ultimately murdered about an hour later. And they, you know, Susan LaBerge, the daughter, her boyfriend was a biker that hung out at the Spahn Ranch. And a lot of people think that she was involved with Tex, and there might have been a reason why, Manson headed up that way because of Tex. And something that's really fascinating to find because they live next door. Now, Manson hung out next door to the LaBianca house, so they think that Susan, Mrs. LaBianca's daughter, may have met Manson that way and was a party girl and became friends with Tex that way. And some people think that Susan, Mrs. LaBianca's daughter, told Tex that Mrs. LaBianca had some sort of money up there, and that may have been what prompted the whole thing. And I do think that most of this was down to money, robbery. There was no helter-skelter. That was a story that Mr. Bugliosi, the prosecutor, used to weave the whole thing together, and it existed on a small level. But this is mostly about drugs and paranoia and protection. And Susan LaBerge, Mrs. LaBianca's daughter, has a very curious involvement with all of this. And it's interesting to note that she's very good friends with Tex Watson still. So, but anyway, that's probably more of an answer than you wanted. I'm sorry.
No, absolutely. That's great. Thank you so much. You've been an awesome guest. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you very much for asking me.
Okay. Now, our other co-host, Devin Tate, who brought you to us. Devin, what question do you – I know that you have to have an amazing question.
Well, I have a different type of question. So first, I just wanted to thank Scott for being here. And Scott, I'm always in awe of you, and I have so much respect for the passion and dedication that you have towards seriously researching and preserving these, you know, cultural moments that a lot of people would rather just kind of brush aside and not think about or talk about. But it's so important to understand, you know, the state of the world that we live in with these things that have impacted society and the way that we think about things. So, I love going on your tours, and I love your both incarnations of your gallery and getting to hear your stories. So I just wondered if you could tell us a story. I know you were you're very well respected in Hollywood, and so when they were, when Quentin Tarantino was making the film Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, I know that you were involved, in some way behind the scenes. I don't know if there's much that you're allowed to tell us or what you can tell us, but if any cool stories about working on that would be amazing to hear.
Oh, sure. Well, I mean, Devin, you're like one of my favorite people in Hollywood. So, I mean, I'm honored to be on this show with you, and I thank you for getting me on this show. And for those of you who, I know you guys talked last week about everyone being professional musicians. There's so many of you, and Devin and his brother produced a song for our documentary, The 6 Degrees of Helter Skelter, called The Man, and it's a very 60s. That was an awesome song, and I love that song so very much, and I appreciate
that.
Thank you. And the Tarantino saw the documentary. He I found out later on that he actually showed the documentary, so I know now that Brad Pitt and Leonardo DiCaprio sat through the 6 Degrees of Helter Skelter, which is kind of a fun thing. And Tarantino saw it, and Tarantino, what's fun about him is he could hire a team of researchers. You know, he could hire people to do these things for him, but he went to the people themselves that were, this was their passion or their main interest. I found out not that long ago that Toni Basil, remember her from Mickey, everyone knows her from the 80s, she was a choreographer in the 60s, big on the old Frankie and Annette Beach movies, and she was an Easy Rider, and she's a really accomplished choreographer. Hullabaloo was her show, and he hired her to do all the dancing in Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. So he could have hired a choreographer to do, hey, let's do some 60s dancing, but he went to the person who actually did that, and I think that's why he got in touch with me. So I spent a couple of days with him, and it was a lot of fun. He was a really nice guy. He was really interested in what I had to say. He was respectful. You know, I was expecting to be some kind of douchey Hollywood guy, you know, and there's an element of that, but nothing at all in any way nasty. He was genuinely curious and respectful, and wanted to know, the answers to questions, and used my information in the movie and gave me credit for it, which was pretty cool. So he was interested in the really nerdy, interesting facts that I am obsessed with. Like I told you, I went to the library to find out what was showing on television while the LaBiancas were murdered. I also knew what book that Abigail Folger was reading in bed when Susan Atkins grabbed her and took her into the main room. And Tarantino pulled me aside and wanted to know the name of the book. And, so those are the kind of weird, wanted that I was able to provide, that a team of researchers, you know, people that were really into it would probably overlook. But those are the nerdy things that he totally went for. The sheet music that was on the piano in the room where the murders occurred, he wanted to know what it was. And it ended up being featured a little part in the movie where the Abigail Folger's, you know, singing the song. So those nuggets came, you know, came straight from me, which was a real honor to contribute. And there's a few more that haven't showed up yet because there will be a four-hour movie or four-and-a-half-hour movie ultimately being released, and a lot of the stuff that I provided.
Yeah. I'm just waiting for that. And, yeah, I think the attention to detail, you know, it really showed and it really transported you back to a time that, you know, a lot of us have only heard about and would love to have, you know, seen a little better. So, and being working on Hollywood Boulevard, I felt so lucky to actually see the physical transformation that they, you know, the set designers undertook to take Hollywood back to 1969.
Well, I mean, it was magical. I mean, you know, my favorite year is 1969. I have it tattooed across my forearm, and long before this movie came about. So when Tarantino says, "I want to bring back 1969," I took off my jacket and showed him my tattoo, and he goes, "Yeah, you're the guy." But, you know, being 1969 being my year, the Tate LaBianca murders being my go-to story, and then for a good month or two during that summer, he brought it all back, you know, and being in front of that restaurant where the victims had their last supper and watching that yellow car that I knew that Sharon Tate had pull up into the driveway of that restaurant and watch those four actors representing those four victims wearing the clothes that they wore that night, it was literally time travel. And that was a really special summer to be in Los Angeles.
Yeah, yeah.
That's right. I'll go back to a comment to make, Dr. John. There was one made back in the Navy called My Favorite.
I think you're breaking up. John.
Yeah, you're breaking up. I can't hear you.
Okay. Well, that is the internet. The internet doesn't like it. Is that better?
Not a whole lot.
No.
No one's talking to me.
Well, can you hear us, John?
Anyway.
John?
I can hear you perfectly.
Okay. Yeah, you're breaking up.
I can
up
hear
when
you perfectly.
Okay. You're,
when
you're
you talk,
okay.
All
you hear
is you
breaking
up.
Okay. Well, we thank you for being with us. We hope you'll come back again. Thank you, Devin. Thank you, co-hosts. And we'll see you next week on Murder 123.
Take
okay.
care, everybody.
Thanks, everybody.
Thank you so much. Thank you, guys. Thank you.
Thank you so much for
having
us. Take care, everyone.
Thank you.
Bye. Yeah.